Hello?
Maria?
Yes!
Hi, Stephen.
Hey,
how are you?
Hi.
I wanted to call you, see how you are today, actually.
Oh, well, thank you very much for calling.
Would you describe yourself as high, low, elevated, depressed? What's the language you would use to describe it?
Well, let me see. Maybe an agitated joy.
That's a good phrase. I like that. I'm actually recording this conversation because I'm doing a program about the language of madness. I'm going to say madness. You've, like me and like millions of others, had the most serious side of it. You have bipolar 2, I think, and also what you call unwanted thought syndrome.
Yes. When I was 10 years old, I started to get these sort of unwanted, violent sexual thoughts. The fear that I would act out doing something violent or sexual. So it's like something you don't want to talk about publicly. And I've had that reaction from a few therapists who said, well, I'm going to need to write this up, you know. And it's like,
you've also managed to turn this as grist to your comic mill in your show Lady Dynamite.
Have you ever been diagnosed with any mental illness?
You say diagnosis, I say diagnosis, diagnosis, diagnosis. No, I have, I'm on antidepressants. I have been since I was 19. Oh. And it's like, because I had thoughts of suicide all the time. And I still do, but it's under control.
When one's in an elevated state, a manic state, if one wants to call it that, when one's more exuberant and less inhibited, I find sometimes my language changes. It gets more active and more expressive and more bold.
Well, I do definitely have a love of words that sometimes I've been amazed, like what comes out of me. I know, like when I was off meds, I did have a rush of songs, ideas, jokes, and there was something very exciting and special about it.
Yes, touched with fire,
yeah.
As Kate Redfield Jameson puts it.
And I think that was part of my reason I didn't want to go on a mood stabilizer, because I was much more comfortable with antidepressant. But then when they said, we're putting you on mood stabilizers, I was like, well, then I'm clearly crazy.
It's the opinion of the entire staff that Dexter is criminally insane. Same.
I could think I'm an angel. When I'm swimming, I'm an angel. I'm a swim angel, and that's a swim gel. I love words.
What does that mean?
You're a nut.
You're crazy in the coconut.
What does that mean?
In these programs, we've often enjoyed a dip into the swirling waters that lie between what we say and who we are. When it comes to madness, those waters are particularly deep, turbid, and unpredictable.
You're a nut. You're crazy in the coconut.
This program has a double function, examining the fascinating diversity of words used to describe mental illness, like the Avalanche's choice of crazy as a coconut, for example, and the words we've always used to revel in madness for entertainment. Like the musical artist Peter Henry here, playing the lunatic escaping from the asylum in a sketch from 1933.
Silly, anyone would think that you were a loony.
Didn't you know? They're all loony here. Everybody's daft but me. I'm the king of Siberia. I'm not stopping here much longer.
Why?
As soon as I've caught enough flies, I'm going to harness them to a matchbox and fly over the wall.
This is an area in which double standards apply. We treat mental illness, rightly, with deadly seriousness, but we aren't averse to laughing at it, even those of us who suffer from it. Talking about double standards, the University of Kent was mad enough to appoint a professor of comedy called Oliver Double. Nuts!
I mean, when I was a child, I used to read a comic called Crazy, spelt with a K. Right? This was for children. And yet, a little bit earlier, the BBC radio comedy programs were made according to a guidance document called the Green Book that specifically forbade mentioning psychiatrists, I believe. So there's a really weird sort of set of double standards where, on the one hand, you kind of go, well, we don't want to talk about that because it's too serious and upsetting. But on the other hand, it's crazy, you know. But yes, all those words are very, very good in terms of colourfully describing things that are beyond the norm. And even words like psychotic, which has a very specific meaning within mental illness, people use it often to refer to something wild and creative. So, I don't know, you if you were into punk, for example, you might say, oh, you should hear this new record, it's psychotic, which is a strange thing because, I mean, somebody who suffers from psychosis is probably not that positive a force in their life, or at least I suppose it might be, but it's something they have to deal with, certainly.
Today, the lexicon of psychiatric terms that litter our everyday speech is voluminous. Manic, bipolar, unipolar, obsessive, compulsive, on the spectrum, sociopathic, psychopathic, narcissistic, a veritable rainforest to the cops of vocabulary popularized by previous generations.
This is Andrew Scull at the University of California, San Diego, and I write extensively on the history of psychiatry. In everyday conversation, we drop in things like, he's nuts, he's bonkers, he's one sandwich short of a picnic. I think that's hard to eliminate it because it actually reflects one of the ways in which we, for a long time, looked at madness. I'm not so sure that those terms don't, on occasion, resonate in very unfortunate ways with people who've directly experienced madness, either themselves or because somebody close to them has undergone this sort of trauma. But, you know, that's language for you. It's a trap.
Yes, but it is a trap that we can usually sidestep. I'm playing crazy golf here. Not mentally ill golf. Here's Dr. Double again with a metaphor about duplication.
We understand that those words have that origin, but we tend to use them much more frequently now, I think, in a general sense to describe things. So if I said, oh, that guy's a loony, you know, I wouldn't think somebody would interpret that as meaning, oh, that person is being treated for mental illness. What I think they would interpret me as saying is that person is very irrational or is insanely creative or something.
We place insanity next to creative genius in a sentence because those who can truly free associate seem enviably uninhibited.
Some people think I'm bonkers, but I just think I'm free. Man, I'm just living my life, there's nothing crazy about me.
Plenty have sung about this.
You have Dizzy Rascal singing about being bonkers and enjoying being bonkers. And what he says with his rapping is that, you know, call me bonkers, I don't care, I feel liberated, I feel free.
Gary Nunn is a journalist who writes about language and mental health.
The Black Eyed Peas have done it in their songs. They actually had a song which was quite controversial.
Let's get retarded.
Which was called Let's Get Retarded. Which they had to rephrase to Let's Get It Started. They tried to say, you know, let's throw the rule book out the window, let's get loose, let's have a party, you know, let's be outside the box.
And as someone who's often felt outside the box myself, I can certainly testify to the creative energy that my own bipolar condition has on occasion afforded me. And while it can be extremely challenging, upsetting, desperate, it does have another side to it. There is a lot of insanely creative stuff that comes out of the buzz of the manic side, the elevated state. And with me to probe the language of this madness more deeply is comedian and former psychiatric nurse, the great Joe Brand.
Hello.
I wondered how much language plays a part in the way you deal with both those who are suffering and thinking about treatments and about fictionalising the story of it.
Well, I think language plays a huge part, and there are so many different layers of language about mental health depending on who's using them, really, and how much they know about mental health. So, for example, the way a psychiatrist would discuss a mental health issue is very different from how just someone you met on the street that doesn't actually know anything about it would discuss it. And, you know, for a long time on the comedy circuit, it used to really annoy me that people would use words like nutter and they would, you know, they would do that thing of, oh, I'm sure you've heard this before. It was roses are red, violets are blue. I'm a schizophrenic, so am I.
Yeah.
Because, you know, a lot of people think schizophrenia is just a straightforward split personality disorder. And
yes,
so
I'm beside myself with schizophrenia, that sort of
absolutely.
Thing.
Absolutely. I mean, one thing I kind of noticed when I was a nurse in the 80s was that psychiatrists were kind of reluctant to tell people which label they'd got, you know. I don't know whether that was for fear of upsetting them, you know, whether they didn't want to go, well, you are a paranoid schizophrenic, in our opinion. That was all kind of glossed over, really. And they would make general comments about, oh, you're not yourself, or, do you know what I mean?
So we're going to try this course of treatment to help with these episodes.
Yes, exactly, which means nothing, really.
On the other hand, there is a, you know, doctors are taught from the earliest stage of their education not to use nouns like you are an asthmatic. And there's some sense in that, isn't there?
Well, there is, you know, and ditto nurses as well, because in the 80s, something called the nursing process came into being, in which nurses were discouraged from referring to people as like the liver in bed 23 or the... the lobotomy in bed 27, you know, which like, obviously totally dehumanises people.
On the other hand, of course, such is the almost joyful ingenuity of the playground that I can remember being told some years ago, when it was obvious that words like retard and so on could not be used and schoolchildren were told not to, that, you know, someone was seen dropping a ball in a playground and instantly, challenged, was shouted out at them. So children are always going to take whatever euphemism or friendly word one can apply and they're going to turn it to their own wicked advantage, and one has to sort of admire that in a way.
Well, and it's interesting. I think different generations react against each other. I mean, certainly that happened in comedy, you know, and for a while as well, you would hear people on the radio going, oh, you're so gay, you know, and using that as a pejorative term. So I think things come back like that as a challenge to the sort of orthodoxy. But you just have to work against that. And I actually think, to me, I always try and do those things with humour, because I think if you're very serious about it, that a lot of people will just react in a kind of rather defiant way and carry on.
The language related to places where the mad resided is interesting in itself. If you consider the journey from the sweetly iconic little town of Bethlehem, thence to the hospital of St. Mary of Bethlehem, the first to treat the mentally ill in London, and this name was then shortened to Bedlam, which was used as a place of horrid, voyeuristic entertainment, and enters our vocabulary to describe an episode of the Chuckle Brothers or the chaos at a John Lewis's sale. It was Bedlam. Interestingly, outside the gates of Bedlam was this enormous plaque, a sculpted plaque of two horrible ogreish figures. On the left was melancholy and on the right was raving. And those were the words that described the gamut of madness in those days, melancholy and raving, not far from our own ideas of manic and depressive and bipolar.
Those places were at first called madhouses. By the early 19th century, there was a move away from that terminology, and either the word retreat or the word asylum was widely used. And the idea was a positive one, that this was respite from a hostile world, a place where one could regroup one's mental forces. But over time, the word asylum in particular came to be seen as very much akin to the old madhouse, a place where living corpses were sort of stored until they died. So by the end of the 19th century, as that rather bleak use of language spread, there was an attempt to relabel the old asylums as mental hospitals.
The Looney Hatch, that was based on Coney Hatch, a famously big asylum. Every age seems hell-bent on ridding itself of what it sees as the barbarism of its predecessors, and the language is always the first to be updated. This attempt to banish stigma through word magic applies also to those medical experts we today know as psychiatrists.
Yes, originally in the 18th and into the 19th century, they were referred to as mad doctors. It was a term with an obvious double meaning, just as the word shrinks often suggests that psychiatrists aren't fully in control of their own mental processes. So it did alter meaning. For much of the 19th century, those controlling the asylums, the medical men who ran them, preferred to either refer to themselves as medical psychologists or sometimes as alienists. And in the Anglo-American world, the word psychiatrist, which was originally a German term, was really only adopted in the 20th century.
But these are only words, aren't they? Yes, but whether we're talking about professionals, patients, or places where they're treated, all we have is words. As you know, I'm all for people being able to use them freely. But one of the saddest and most misguided headlines I recall was the Sun newspaper's coverage in 2003 of boxer Frank Bruno's struggle with mental illness. "Bonkers Bruno, locked up," it read. Now, I've used the word bonkers earlier in this programme, and you may say it's hypocritical of me to criticise the Sun for using it, but there's a difference as to where it came from. It's whether we reclaim the word and analyse it, or whether we stigmatise someone as being bonkers Bruno. Here's Gary Nunn.
What we saw with the Sun newspaper some years ago with bonkers Bruno is that they prioritised alliteration over treating a big group of people with respect, and one in four people, so many of their own readers, will experience mental health problems in their lifetime. And they had to quickly dash out new and more sensitive headlines because their own readers were giving them backlash. Rightly so, I would say. So they dashed out another headline, which was "Sad Bruno in Mental Health Hospital" or something similar to that.
I wonder whether Rebecca Brooks's apologetic words of admission that this was a terrible mistake were enough. There is now a style guide compiled by the Time to Change campaign, which advises the media on their use of language associated with mental health.
Somebody who is angry is not psychotic. Schizophrenic or bipolar should not be used to mean two minds or a split personality, or be used metaphorically to describe something with two different sides. A person who is down or unhappy is not the same as someone experiencing clinical depression.
The trouble is that when it comes to language, what we say and how we say it may often be very different from what others hear or choose to hear. Meet Jess Tom. She's an artist, writer and comedian. She also has Tourette's syndrome.
So biscuit, Tourette's is a neurological condition, biscuit, that's characterised, biscuit, by involuntary biscuit movements and noises called tics, biscuit. The movements are called motor tics, and the noises are called vocal tics, biscuit. And everyone with Tourette's, biscuit, will have at least one vocal tic, biscuit, and multiple motor tics, biscuit.
A motor tic is a physical tic, like thumping your chest, for example, which is what you can hear Jess doing.
When I was travelling around a lot more independently, biscuit, on the bus than I do at the moment, biscuit, I used to be very aware of other people's fear of me, and biscuit, particularly if I'm on my own, and therefore biscuit, not having a conversation with someone. All someone's hearing, the only voice they're hearing, is my ticked voice. Is their biscuit is the language of my ticks, biscuit. So they make loads of assumptions and judgments based on that. They have no sense of biscuit who I am, biscuit hedgehog. So I would, as a strategy, I would often make a phone call to a friend, just so people around me could hear my chosen voice and hear that I had friends and that I was capable of a thoughtful conversation.
Having Tourette's gives Jess a very unusual relationship with language.
Language is a big part of my life. Biscuit, I say loads and loads of words, biscuit, every day, but only half of them, biscuit, are actually my deliberate communication. The tics can draw on anything, biscuit, I've known or experienced. So really unusual ideas get thrown together to create new concepts. Biscuit, hedgehog, biscuit. But I have no control over what they are. I have no idea what they're going to be. So I had a conversation with my friend Matthew where he described a Tourette's as a crazy language generating machine and told me, biscuit, not doing something creative with them would be wasteful, biscuit. And that idea really took root and transformed how I was able to think about them and transformed my relationship with language, actually, biscuit. Until that point, I'd only seen Tourette's as a problem, and that helped me see it as a power and see the value in some of the unusual ideas, biscuit, that I said.
The neurologist Oliver Sacks became world famous for communicating the bizarreness but also the humanity of his case studies. One of his fascinating distinctions was between pathologies of deficit and those of excess. And in the case of Tourette's speech, he described an excess excess or superabundance of function, which, when treated and channeled, could lead to staggering amounts of creative output. Jess actually wants people to laugh at some of the surreal and funny things that her crazy language machine produces. It has, after all, inspired a whole live show called Backstage at Biscuitland.
Biscuit? Well, I'm not showing people around Biscuitland. Or shouting at lampposts. I love you, lampposts. Get a job, lamppost. Get a solar panel, lamppost.
OK, let's not get distracted by lampposts.
Biscuit.
The wonderful Jess Tom with her Biscuitland and everything else, who's kind of reclaimed Tourette's. Joe, there is humour in human beings behaving in a way that's not expected, but then it's not funny at some other end of the continuum. And I wondered how permissible humour is in this condition.
I think it's very difficult to police your kind of automatic reactions, really, because a lot of humour is about what's buried very deep inside and what you consider to be taboo. So I think constantly your kind of id is fighting, you know, a losing battle, because you know you shouldn't find something funny and yet inside you do.
Yes. And I suppose the interesting side of it is that in the world you know best and I know a little, which is stand-up comedy, it's fine if you're in a lucid period to be a stand-up, but the very nature of comedy is that it is actually, it demands sanity in as much as it demands a clear understanding and an ability to communicate a reality, the reality of your experience. So if I'm utterly depressed, I couldn't go on stage. Because I couldn't say the things. And if it happened to be so manic that I'm, you know, sort of out of control, my exuberances, you know, I would be inappropriate, shall we say, on stage. So I have to be sane in order to talk about my insanity.
Yes, well, I think so, because I think a lot of doing stand-up, it's kind of about control, isn't it, really? It's about stand-ups controlling the mood and the reaction of an audience and almost like being like a teacher, if you like. And I think if you're out of control and your behaviour's very unpredictable, that actually an audience would lose faith in your ability to perform very quickly, and so it would all collapse. For example, you know, there are comics like Eddie Izzard who express maybe a symptom of, you know, the manic phase of bipolar disorder by doing sort of flight of ideas or jumping from one topic to another and expressing abstract ideas in a kind of odd way. The point is that it's controlled by him.
But are we getting better at understanding the fine line between sanity, insanity and eccentricity, for example? It's a question which John Ronson asks in his book about psychopaths.
My name is John Ronson and I'm the author of several books, including a book called The Psychopath Test.
The book is a journey into what he calls the madness industry. And in it, he meets a number of high-profile purported psychopaths. The key to understanding this particular strain of quote-unquote madness is something called the PCLR checklist.
It's a 20-point checklist, which is like the gold standard of psychopathy diagnosis. Do you want me to find it for you?
Yes, please do.
Okay, let me find the checklist. Oh, I've got the checklist straight away. Even though the checklist isn't specifically about language or linguistics, it's about behaviour, it kind of is about language. This is what's really interesting. When they were teaching me psychopathy diagnosis, so much of it was about linguistic clues, which I thought was so interesting. So one of the kind of classic psychopath traits is failure to accept responsibility for own actions. So the way that translates linguistically is victim blaming. He shouldn't have looked at me that way. It was his own fault. Another one is kind of shallow affect, which is an inability to experience emotions. So that manifests itself in lots of really interesting linguistic ways. There's a real superficiality, and you get the sense that there's nothing really going on under the surface. So one time I was interviewing this Haitian death squad leader who escaped justice and moved in with his mother in Queens. And he started crying and saying, you know, I'm innocent of all the charges. And he was crying. And I looked up at him and I realised that he was only pretending to cry. It was like really hammy. So again, that's a kind of classic psychopathic thing. So lots of the items on the checklist manifest themselves in linguistic ways like that.
When it comes to the psychopath, then, there's a complete inability to recognise their own deficit of empathic and emotional language, and therefore an inability to own their madness. And it's this ownership of one's mental state which is ultimately so important. I can say, I have bipolar disorder. But a psychopath can't say, I'm a psychopath. They don't have the intuition and empathy and understanding to be able to say it. And this ownership is so important to the extent that many people with challenging mental health conditions now want to be called mad.
Interestingly, rather like the way in which some segments of the gay community have reacquired the term queer and use it as a proud term of identification, so too some of the people who are opposed to modern psychiatry, who often call themselves psychiatric survivors, have now preferred to turn to the word mad to describe themselves, to avoid associating themselves with the idea that their condition is a form of illness.
Do I seem a little loony?
Well,
I am a little loony.
You've said it.
For I've not been feeling myself all day. It's in the air.
And there is even something called Mad Pride Day now, similar to Gay Pride. It's held on Bastille Day, 14 Juillet, because of its associations with liberation and freedom. Joe, do you think Mad Pride is a goable idea? Do you think it's a good idea?
Well, I think it's a very positive thing to kind of reclaim words that have been used against you. I mean, it is a few years ago now, but I was invited to something on Camberwell Green in South London called Bonkers Fest. This was a group of people with mental health issues that wanted to take a kind of celebratory approach to talking about their problems. And what was so great at the beginning was they opened the festival by firing a big cannon of bananas out at people because the whole bananas connection, you know, your bananas. Yes. It was just like a kind of carnival atmosphere, really. And I think that's really important for people to kind of feel they're retaining something themselves rather than giving it over for psychiatrists and psychologists to kind of give them labels, really.
Zoom, 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 high and low. Zoom, 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 here we go, it's in the air.